You ever notice that James refers to the Torah as the perfect Torah of liberty, the perfect Torah of freedom? Well, there's a whole story behind that, behind what he means. It has to do with the cutting out of the letters of the commandments on the tablets of the Ten Commandments, but we won't get into that today. I just like that. I like that expression. The perfect Torah of liberty. It doesn't sound very much like Paul, does it? It sounds like James, not Paul. Tonight we're dealing with some of Paul's use of the Torah and the way that he speaks about the Torah. And I find that this is sort of a difficult passage. I had a little bit of angst once again going into it. But my friend and colleague Aaron Eby helped me out with this one. So got an email from him at about very, very early this morning. I don't know, very early this morning. The email was waiting for me and helped me put together a few things on Romans 7. So, just in the nick of time. Great. So, here's my issue. Here's my consternation. It's this analogy. And I've actually taught this before, so I don't know why I was so angst, you know, because I taught it in Hayesod, of course. But, you know, I mean, just coming around to it again, it's just always, what is Paul talking about? It's frustrating. I mean, even if I wasn't messianic, even if I was on the side of the laws done away with, I'd be frustrated in trying to sort this out and make this all, make logical, consistent sense. By the way, I forgot to mention, and I should mention right now, have this event coming up September 12th and 14th, or September 12th through the 14th, actually. This is Rabbi Baruch of Love Israel is going to be back in town. And so Derek Skoglund, who attends the class here, he is the U.S. representative of Rabbi Baruch and their ministry, Love Israel. So I know he would love to see some people from the class out for some of these nights. So Rabbi Baruch is going to be in my town, in St. Paul, at Summit Avenue Church, and he's going to be speaking about the prophetic roles of Elijah and John the Baptist for the kingdom. So you can, if you think you might want to go, you could just take this with you or take down the information or something like that. Also, Acts for Messiah coffee over here, $13 a bag. We have it ground or whole bean, your choice. So Sylvia would be collecting the proceeds for that. All right, so let's get into this difficult analogy of Romans 7. I've written it out here without interpolation just so that you can also see that it's a difficult analogy. All right? Do you not know, brothers, for I am speaking to those who know the law, that the law is binding on a person only as long as he lives? All right, that makes sense. Not so difficult so far, right? For a married woman is bound by law to her husband while he lives. But if her husband dies, she is released from the law of marriage. That's true. That's all true. Accordingly, she will be called an adulteress if she lives with another man while her husband is alive. But if her husband dies, she is free from that law. And if she marries another man, she is not an adulteress. So far, so good. Right? Okay. Likewise, my brothers, you also have died to the law through the body of Christ, so that you may belong to another, to him who has been raised from the dead, in order that we may bear fruit for God. For while we were living in the flesh, our sinful passions aroused by the law were at work in our members to bear fruit for death. But now we are released from the law, having died to that which held us captive, so that we serve in the new way of the Spirit and not in the old way of the written code. All right, now that's this is where it gets a little difficult, because, well, first of all, it's not difficult. It's not so difficult from a traditional Christian perspective, where we say, well, yeah, Paul's telling everybody they're released from the law, that the law, they died to the law is dead, and so now they are bound to Christ instead of the old way of the Torah, the old written code. Instead, they have the law of the Spirit, the new way of the Spirit. That's all, we understand all that from a traditional Christian theological perspective. But here's what's difficult, even from that perspective. The analogy gets all, out of kilter. Because the analogy, if you're following the analogy here, let's just, without looking ahead at your sheets, let's see if we can parse this out. Who is the woman? Well, she must be, in the analogy, she must be...
Us.
Yeah, us. Us. Okay, right on. And who is the her first husband then?
It'd be the law.
And who is her second husband? Yeah, Messiah. All right, so that's how the analogy works. But wait a second, this is like not exactly how the analogy ran when Paul presented it. Instead, as he presented it, he said the law was functioning as the legal reality that represents her duty to be bound to her husband. So now it's like the imagery in the analogy has actually shifted on us imperceptibly almost until we didn't even know what had happened. And now we're in this strange situation where the woman turned out to be married to her marriage. Not married to her husband, not married to a husband, but married to her obligation to a husband. It doesn't make sense. That's what I'm saying. Do you understand? No. Good. That's what I'm saying. Doesn't make sense. All right. So let's back up. Sometimes it's helpful to back up. You know, when you gotta like, sometimes you gotta back up and take a run at something, right? So let's back up and take a run at it. We're going to back up to what we learned last week, which was the argument in Romans 6. Remember the argument in Romans 6? The whole premise of the argument in Romans 6 was that if the Gentile believers are not under the Torah, not under the law, which is what Paul is arguing for, that they shouldn't have to be under the law. In other words, they should not have to be Jewish. So you're saying the Gentile believers, the God-fearing Gentile believers, they're not under the Torah. But then other people are saying, okay, well then if they're not under the Torah, I guess they can sin and sin freely, huh? So why shouldn't Gentiles continue to sin, that grace may abound and so forth, right? And so they're kind of trying to take Paul to task. And he presented us with two answers. First of all, he said, well, first, they're dead to sin. They're believers. They've been baptized. They've been immersed into Yeshua. So they died with him and they were raised with him. They died to sin and they're raised to live toward God. All right, remember that argument? Died with Messiah and was raised with Messiah. Second argument, he said, and here, let me give you an analogy. He said, you know that when you serve someone as a slave, you're a slave to the one you serve, right? As Bob Dylan says, right? So you're going to, he said, you can be a slave to righteousness, or you can be a slave to sin. Previously, they were slaves to sin, these God-fearing Gentile believers, these Romans, they were slaves to sin, as he described in the first chapter of Romans with all of that, you know, all that tawdry description of these Gentiles, right? So you used to be slaves to sin, but now you are a slave to righteousness. So just as you're a slave to sin and that was producing death, resulted in death, now you are a slave to righteousness. Now these Gentiles are slaves to righteousness. So that's why they can't sin. Even though they're not under the law, they still have to keep the commandments because they are slaves to righteousness. That was last week, right? Now, here's what we're going to do. We're going to line up. So you see the slave analogy here. Let's just run through this, and then we're going to line up the two analogies. In the slave analogy of Romans 6, who's the slave? The Roman Gentile. His first master? Sin. That's very clear. Very, very clear. It's obviously not the law. He's not under the law. He's the God-fearing Gentile. And anyway, Paul says, it's sin if you serve sin. The labor that he performs for this master, what is it? In the analogy in Romans 6, it's lawlessness and impurity. Those are the words Paul uses. So, So you're a slave, you're serving a mean slave master named sin, and he makes you do lawlessness and impurity. That's what you do. And then he pays you your wages, and what's your wages? Death. It's a bad deal. The wages of sin are death, right? Okay, so what are you going to do? You get sold to another master buys you, right? And now this second master, what's his name? Well, his name is obedience. And the labor that you do for obedience is called righteousness. This is all in Romans 6. I'm not making this up. I'm not being legalistic or something. It's just right there in Romans 6, okay? And the wages that he pays you are eternal life. Okay, that was last week. We learned all that last week. Why are we going over all this again? Because we're going to compare the two analogies now. The slave must be in some sense equivalent then to the woman of Romans 7, right? Not the same, but in some sense, they're going to play a similar role in these two analogies. The first master then must be in some sense equivalent to the first husband. The second master must be in some sense equivalent to the second husband. And the wages, which are mentioned in Romans 6, are going to be equivalent to the fruit, that is the offspring of the marriage, that's mentioned in Romans 7. All right, so if we do this, if we look at it from this perspective, if that's the case, we can clearly see that the second master, which in Romans 6 was obedience, and in Romans 7 is Messiah, you know, so that's okay. Then who's the, and we see that the first master in Romans 6 is sin. How do we come to the first husband being Torah? You see the problem here? The disconnect? All right. So, we're backing up. We're taking a run at this. I'm suggesting to you that whatever the value of first master in Romans, in the analogy in Romans 6, whatever that means, it has to mean the same in Romans 7, first husband. You know, it works so well in Hebrew where the word for master and husband is identical, you know. Well, there's two words for husband. There's ish, which just means man, you know. So ishi, my man, right? That's one way that a woman might address her husband. But the more normal word is Baal, so which is master. So you can see how Paul's thinking Hebrew, he's writing Greek, he's thinking Hebrew type of thing, you know. Okay. So the first master, whatever the first master is, that has to in some sense be equivalent to the first husband, just as obedience was equivalent to Messiah. Yes.
I've got the Catholic Bible here in the New Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And even 6:13 in the Catholic Bible says, or give any parts of your bodies over to sin to be used as instruments in evil. Instead, give yourselves to God.
Mm-hmm.
Obedience is
there you
clear,
go.
Even in the
right.
Catholic Bible.
Very nice. Excellent. Okay, so that's Romans 6. We backed up. We're taking a run at it. Now let's look at the argument in Romans 7. We can start to tackle this material. It won't take too long. So Romans 6 was all about making the argument for Gentile believers, yes? My idea, I might be wrong about this, but my idea is that Romans 7 is making the argument that Jewish believers also have a new relationship to the Torah. They also have. So, just as Romans 6 was saying, the Gentiles who are not under the law, they have to, nevertheless, they have to walk in obedience. Romans 7 is going to turn to the proselytes and Jewish believers and say, and your situation is identical or similar or, you know, very, very similar. What is their situation? Here's the argument he's going to make. He's going to make this argument. He's going to say, as Jewish believers, you've had a change in status too. Just as these Gentiles these God-fearing Gentiles had a change in status from being slaves to sin to becoming slaves to righteousness. You've had a change in status. You are no longer under the law of sin and death. Now, we already learned what the law of sin and death is in this class. The law of sin and death is the law that says the wages of sin is death. All right? So he's saying you've had a change in status as well. And there is no condemnation for those in Messiah. Whereas previous to your situation of coming to faith in Messiah and being identified with Messiah, there was condemnation. But now, there is no condemnation. So this is the change in status, all right? All right, so this is the argument. That's the big argument of Romans 7. And now let's talk about this idea of law of sin and death. He's already determined for us. We've already learned the wages of sin is death. We saw other passages in earlier weeks. For example, Romans 5:12. Sin came into the world through one man and death through sin. So death spread to all men because all sinned. And Romans 6:16. Sin leads to death. You can't say it any clearer than that. Now here's what I'm suggesting to you. I'm going to suggest that Paul uses ambiguous, provocative language in Romans 7 deliberately to incite his readers and to get them upset and to say, whoa, what's he saying? What's he saying? And then when he gets to a certain point, he says, hey, don't get me wrong. Here's what I'm really saying. And he gives you a 180. But if you miss the 180, and you take the deliberately provocative language, you probably will get them wrong. So what's the deliberately provocative and ambiguous language? It's the word law. The word law, nomos in Greek, has all sorts of connotations. It can mean Torah. And if you just use it as Paul uses it, the nomos, it certainly has that implication. He's talking about the Torah. It can mean Torah. It can mean civil law. In this context, it's going to mean Jewish law, halakhic law, marital law, is some of the ways that he's going to be using it. And then he's going to introduce nomos as the law of sin and death. So he's going to use this ambiguity of the word nomos as he turns his argument to address the Jewish believers and the proselytes about whether or not God-fearing Gentiles need to come under the nomos, under the law. This is his larger argument. I know that sounds confusing, but I thought I would just give you the punchline right at the outset, and then as we're working through it, maybe it'll be easier for you to start seeing how he's using the language and using the arguments. That's it. That's the introduction. Now we can get into the text.